It is Monday, June 7th. Welcome to LA Podcast. My name is Alyssa Walker. We have Hayes Davenport, Scott Frazier. How you doing?
You know, pretty good.
Okay.
Got a bit. How many episodes?
My friend Alyssa brought bagels for me to eat this morning, so I'm all right.
That's a good friend. Yeah, shout out to Maury's Bagels who listens to the podcast. I have heard.
Yeah,
maybe this is our first sponsorship.
That is our one real loyalty business.
America runs on Maury's. You could say.
We have a couple perks this week for Sepulveda pass holders on our Patreon, patreon.com/LA podcast. We have a 30 Mile Zone episode where we're watching every movie ever made about LA. Scott and I watched Cradle to the Grave, starring the late DMX and Jet Li. And we have an exciting show today. Mayor Garcetti has one final controversy on his way out of Los Angeles.
It took like some real dexterity, I think, to squeeze this one in before he left the country.
The last one. One more. And we have some updates from Sacramento and the state legislature, some legislation coming out of there. We have a place and thank you segment about a big ship that I'll talk about. And also we're going to talk about these holding sites for child migrants in LA County. These have been up for a while. We haven't discussed them yet, so we're going to get into them today. But first, do we have any LA stories?
Do you have any?
Oh boy, I saw something nuts.
What'd you see?
So I was at friend of the
show. I'm loving this lead up.
I had to check to make sure it actually happened the next day. So I was at Jessica Meany's house, friend of the show. She lives in Echo Park. And we hear this. I don't even know what sound it was. It was the most phenomenal crash I have ever heard. Did a building blow up? Did something run into a building? Like it just sounded so bad, like screeching, endless, the catapulting of metal sound. And then we started hearing like the fire trucks and ambulances go. So we go to look. 7 cars on a very small street, like not like Baxter, but like one of the small ones in the canyon up in Echo Park. And one was turned on its side and the one that caused it drove away. And you have every single person that's coming out of their houses look like basically walking into what felt like a film shoot for Fast and the Furious. Mm-hmm. Like it didn't even look like it could have happened. Things were like smoking. Like it was like, and I don't know how you could get going that fast to have all these cars hit each other on this small street. But then I realized we have turned Allegiant Park into basically a freeway that goes through a park. And all those cars are coming out of there, like, especially after Dodger games and stuff like that. Like, yeah, not that there's not traffic or whatever, but there's money going to improvements to the park right now. They're going to fix some of the playgrounds and some other things. But like there's still places in Allegiant Park that don't even have curb ramps or safe places to walk across the street when you're hiking. There are literally hiking trails that like stop on either end of a 4-lane road that goes just right through the middle of the park. So can we get like the park to act like a park when it comes to sharing it with cars? I mean, it's like it was a really terrifying thing to see that. And I would be scared if I live there, especially when there's not traffic, less than when there is traffic.
And they have, I mean, I think for this part of town, at least in particular, I'm aware of, there's been like a huge increase in street racing too, right? Like,
I mean, that's the other thing I might have, it definitely could have been attributed to that. I don't know how you flip a car over on its side on a very, it's a narrow street. I mean, it was just, it was absolute. And I think only one person got hurt, but the sound, I can still hear the sound right now. And it was just that nobody like walking or in their house got hurt was, whew.
Wow.
My LA story is, it's fireworks season.
Yes.
We're back. Yeah. We are back after the spring lull that we get in between New Year's Eve and Memorial Day. Wow. We are back. I had a really good Memorial Day, actually. Just like felt like the kind of back to normal that we artificially tried to do last Memorial Day. We were like, okay, we're done with this. We're done with this pandemic now. This one actually felt much more normal. Got to hang out with friends, got to see people, and made some pina coladas, but the big highlight for me is, oh yeah, I forgot. It's going to be a long couple months of just mm-hmm. explosives immediately over my head is what it sounds
Can
like.
Can you hear a difference in fireworks culture in your new place compared to your old one?
Honestly,
about the same.
It's pretty consistent.
Yeah.
The one thing that I would say is my old place was sort of tucked down, whereas now we're like a little bit up on a mm-hmm. hill or embankment. So I feel
the
like
fireworks are coming to you.
Yeah, they're coming at me.
Yeah,
they really feel like they're coming at me. That's me. That's where I'm at this week.
Last weekend, after we recorded a little Elysian Park detail, I went to the Dodger game with my parents.
Nice.
You all experienced this when we went a few weeks ago for Scott's birthday, but there's this phenomenon now when you're going into the game, there's an equally large stream of people coming out mm-hmm. as you're entering because they were told that they couldn't bring their even like tiny little
purses. We should have done a PSA about this.
We should have. Yeah. We could have.
Now we're doing it.
Yeah. Hours of their lives. But there's like a second game going on at the entrance of Dodger Stadium of people negotiating whether or not they can take their bags in, then pointing to someone else's bag who got in and saying like, well, that's the same size as Ryan. And they're like, well, but it's clear. And like eventually they will just give up. Like you can spend your time just wearing them down at security, or you can just walk back to your car and put your bag in.
You have to give up.
Well, our problem was we didn't have a car and there were lockers. Mm-hmm. Very far away from where that entrance was. But won't that change? Will that all be done after the 15th when it's full capacity?
That's what Gavin Newsom announced this week, is that
clear bag mandate.
You still can't take your
everyone has to carry clear bags everywhere.
Well, what we heard, or what we were told, was that it wasn't related to COVID at all. It was about like mass shootings, mm-hmm. the other pandemic that we're never going to reach the end of. So I don't think that that's going to change. It seems like that's just the way that it is now.
Can invest in some cute looking clear bags.
And my other short little story was we had a Sela partisan this week that crashed his bike and a couple of days later was just like feeling in a lot of pain. So I took him to the ER and then went to go pick him up. And he had we went to Hollywood Presbyterian on Vermont. And when I went to pick him up, he had started kind of moving up the street on crutches, and I was talking to him and he's like, it was great. There's nothing broken. Like everything's fine. And I got a free movie ticket and I'm like, what? They give out free movie tickets to the ER now? What happened? And he's like, yeah, I get to go to this movie. And he showed me the ticket and it was for the Scientology, Life of L. Ron Hubbard.
Yes.
Someone in a suit.
Wow.
As he was exiting the hospital saying like, here's your movie ticket.
Want to really feel better?
they're permanently camped out there. That was really funny. We have some exciting news. This does not qualify for a Say It Ain't So update, but we did get word from David Zonizer of the LA Times that this past week, former city council member Mitch Englander, formerly of the 12th District in the Valley, has been transferred into federal custody. He will be staying for the next year-ish in Tucson, Arizona, a place that I'm very familiar with. But he will be in a part of it that I am not familiar with, which is the maximum security prison.
Medium, right?
It is a maximum security prison, but he is in the lower
wing.
Yeah, he's in the annex. Like, he's in the satellite facility with just 100 other prisoners, by the way. So he's going to be there for about a year. And we are going to introduce a new segment that we call Pour One Out, where each of us is going to respond to this news in one word. Alyssa, do you want to start?
Hot. It's getting me hot there. It's getting me real hot. Mm-hmm. Hot boy summer.
My word is, this is what I think Englander whispers through the bars every night at Lights Out, which is, Lee. Guys, in his seat was supposed to be his friend and knew about all this, and he's getting away with it.
Mine is hyphenated, one word, Massage ladies. Happy trails to Councilmember Mitch Englander. Let us let's get into the news of the week. Hayes.
This is a fascinating story that is continuing to unfold. So we don't talk that often about the citizens' commissions of Los Angeles, but pretty much all the big, we talked about the police commission, but pretty much all the big departments in the city have commissions appointed by the mayor. They work for free. It is for some reason considered to be a desirable job among like movers and shakers in the city. And it's like a political gift often to friends of the mayor. This job sounds horrible to me, but they have a fair amount of discretionary power. There's a DWP commission. There's a the citizen, like human rights commission. There's a LASA commission, I think.
There are a ton of them.
There's a lot.
Basically for every department.
Yes.
And then some.
And they can make decisions for the department that they oversee. And this week we're talking about the fire commission. And then right now it is truly a fire commission. A guy who sits on the board of fire commissioners, Andrew Glazier, was appointed by Mayor Garcetti, and he was essentially let go this week. His term is expiring, and that normally means that you get reinstated. Like, no one is ever, your contract is always extended when your term expires until the mayor is out, and then the new mayor comes in and appoints their own people. You just stay in it forever.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So this guy, Andrew Glazier, he's considered one of the more progressive members of this five-member commission, and he was let go by the mayor.
And not only is it basically an automatic reappointment, the LA Times pointed out that they were, at least at some point in the past, pretty close. Eric Garcetti officiated his wedding.
His wedding, yes.
So it's not like they don't know each other personally.
Yes. And he was let go. He wanted to stay. And he has now said that he was let go at the demand of the president of UFLAC, the firefighters union, a guy named Freddie Escobar.
Yep.
And his theory, Andrew Glazier's theory, and that of other people that sit on this commission and other people that operate in this world, is that Freddie Escobar demanded Andrew Glazier be fired as a trade for accepting this therapeutic transportation pilot program. And this is something that Mayor Garcetti initiated coming out of the George Floyd protests. That is an alternative emergency response service staffed by social workers, but it would operate out of fire departments. It'd be non-firefighters, non-UFLAC people stationed at fire departments that would go out on calls. Yeah. And the mayor wants this to be kind of a signature when he can, in running for future office, that he can point back to, like, oh, we made these reforms as I was leaving. I got this therapeutic transportation pilot program done. And UFLAC is pushing back because they don't like non-firefighters in their fire station eating all their spaghetti and like
firehouse cuisine.
Hogging the prime spots at karaoke.
Yes. Yeah. Sliding down the pole just for fun.
And so Freddie Escobar, the president of UFLAC, is saying, we did not demand that Andrew Glazier be fired. We're very happy that he was. He sucks. We don't like this guy. But we also have not agreed to this program yet. So how could you call it a quid pro quo when we are still standing in the way of this alternative response program?
There was a really interesting, I mean, I forgot, it was kind of a funny quote from the union that was like, if we were going to do quid pro quo, why would we do it for something this small? Like,
yes,
we would go much bigger than, I think they said, why would we do it for an advisory committee member?
Yes. At the same time, another fire commissioner, Rebecca Ninberg, who is said to be an ally of Andrew Glazier, said that someone from the mayor's office reached out to her and also tried to move her off of the fire commission.
Wow.
At the same time. So maybe that's what Freddie Escobar is talking about. It's like, why wouldn't we go bigger and try to get rid of two fire commissioners, which it seems like maybe they did attempt to do.
Where there's smoke, there's the fire union.
One of the most interesting things to me both the, there's a group called the Stentorians, which is the black firefighters. And there's also a female firefighters organization, which famously makes up about 3% of all firefighters, despite some efforts in the city. They both spoke up and said this was a really bad idea to fire Andrew Glazier.
Yeah.
So the black firefighters and the female firefighters are going up against the union, mm-hmm. which is mostly men, mostly yep. not black, and saying that this was a bad decision, that they're very upset that Andrew Glazier is leaving this post.
I mean, this is kind of where we get into, in my opinion, the most interesting part about this, because over the course of the 2010s, like pretty much the entire time that Eric Garcetti has been the mayor of the city, there has been a drumbeat of stories about how do you change the culture of the LA Fire Department? Mm-hmm. How do you make it? And this isn't necessarily unique to the LA Fire Department. I think that across the country, there are, especially in major cities, attempts to figure out how you achieve anything even resembling gender equity in fire departments, which are...
Gender equity, the goal is 5%.
Jesus.
That's the goal, and they have not been able to meet it.
But it's interesting because, you know, whatever else you can say about Garcetti, he's been actively trying to figure out how to boost the ranks of women in roles where they historically have not been able to make much headway. He I think said that 50% of his appointees were going to be women. I'm fairly positive he's either kept to or exceeded that number. Mm-hmm. And he has focused during his time in trying to like do studies on what does the culture of the fire department look like, and why haven't we been able to change that? So his appointees have taken that approach, have, mm-hmm. You know, supported studies. I saw one just a couple months ago that was a look at the status of women in the fire department. And it is believable to me that that is supported by the Centaurians and the female firefighters and by the much larger body of the UFLAC, that it is widely disparaged. So that seems like that's maybe where this is coming from.
This is also not really the first time this kind of thing has happened. A couple years ago, in 2018, 2019, UFLAC pushed for a fire investigator, a fire marshal named John Vidovich, who was trying too hard to enforce rules about like catching up on inspections. The fire department was way behind on a lot of inspections, and he was accusing firefighters of not doing these inspections, billing for work that hadn't been completed. And so UFLAC went to the mayor's office and said, this guy has to be fired. And he was. The mayor's office at one point was trying to figure out a way to give him a job in the mayor's office to get him out of the fire department, and they ended up settling and paying him $800,000 for that firing. UFLAC, we don't talk about this. You know, we talk about the PPL.
Yeah.
And I think this UFLAC gets by on firefighters having a much better reputation than yeah. police officers do.
Also, but what we're talking about is, I think it is sort of just a reflection of the more insular role that the fire departments have in our society. I think that's also how they have gotten away with having a 3%. Like, for the goal to be doubling a 3% rate of female firefighters is a reflection really of the fact that this group of people interacts with very, very few members of the public, and very few members of the public apparently have an opinion about them, yeah. other than just they put out fires. They come with the ambulance when you're in mm-hmm. distress, whatever.
But they're super politically powerful.
Yep.
Every elected official wants their endorsement. They throw a ton of money around every election cycle.
Right.
And this story, I think, is going to expand over the next few weeks as Garcetti flees the United States. Let's talk about Sacramento. Let's go to the State House. What are some bills? There was a flurry of activity this week as we approach the end of the legislative cycle. Yeah. What happened?
So we have a lot of really good forward motion on some bills. It is not the May massacre that it was in years past, and some transportation ones to highlight in particular. I've been reporting over the last week of what's been going on in New York State. They have 8 bills that are at the in the legislature right now, all having to do with reducing traffic deaths, specifically things like allowing cities to reduce their speed limits, doing like a victim,
which we cannot do, which has not moved forward, I didn't realize that
anywhere else had that same stipulation.
They can't go lower than 25 miles per hour, which is a problem in parts of New York where they're asking to go below 25. Imagine that being the problem that we have in the city, which is clearly
like in Portland, they have not a 20 even is 20
there. Yeah, they have 20 on their neighborhood streets, and things like a SUV sticker for to warn people that this vehicle is more dangerous for pedestrians. I don't know if that will convince people, but that's one of the things.
That stickers coming towards you? Yeah. You're like, oh, I should get out of the way.
They don't pay attention to the sticker that says how much money they're going to pay in gas, but they surely will pay attention to this other sticker. And a bunch of other things, including they have speed cameras in New York, of course, but this would allow them to be turned on day and night. They turn them on only during the day in a lot of places to get like school-related infractions, but this would allow them to run all night. Anyway, a great... 8 amazing bills that look very good in New York State. And here we had kind of like a few attempts to chip away at our auto dependent empire that's taken over the state. And earlier this month,
Autopia, Disney's going to sue us.
There was we had our own speed camera bill, which actually got held in appropriations earlier this month, or last month, sorry, in May. That was actually supported by a very wide coalition, but California Walks with some other groups had really raised some serious equity concerns. So it's not really clear what happened to that bill. There wasn't any kind of vote or anything, so we didn't really see, you know, what was going to happen or what will change. But it could be one of those bills where it gets held and then they bring it back, a la every housing bill that gets brought through. We don't know the story. Another really one that did just pass the assembly and is moving to the Senate is AB 1238, and this is a jaywalking bill, which would basically decriminalize jaywalking in the state. This I was really excited about. Los Angeles Walks was one that was pushing this. This was Phil Ting who brought this before the legislature. And it's really just not allowing cops to stop people for something that everybody does every day, which is, of course, disproportionately affects particularly Black Californians. The data is really nuts when it comes to who is getting stopped, what are they getting stopped for, and also the fact that the streets that are most likely to be unsafe to cross are in the communities that are more heavily populated by people who are Black or people of color. So this, I think, is like a huge step forward if it can also be tied to making the improvements on the streets. A really cool thing in Mexico City that when they started to decriminalize their jaywalking, it was allowing people to cross streets wherever they felt safe as long as they were 2 lanes across. So if you think about how few of our streets are 2 lanes across and how it could be paired with some real changes, it could be very promising. So that goes to the Senate.
One of my earliest, just to say, as California's enforcement of jaywalking laws is wild. Yeah. And it really, I don't know that it has much of a mirror anywhere else that I'm aware of. It is such a weird part of our culture. And it is, it's very clearly a tool to harass Black and brown young men, mostly. One of my earliest memories of even knowing what police were was being in the city of Long Beach, visiting family when I was a kid. And we were like leaving Bubba Gump at like down by the waterfront. And 2 Long Beach police officers stopping a Black man crossing what is basically a fake street for jaywalking. And they ended up putting him in the back of their car and taking him to jail.
What?
So, yeah.
Well, and that, I mean, who knows what he was taken to jail for, but often it's like the pretextual, it's like the reason to run someone's information to.
It was like, in this case for like giving them attitude about being stopped for jaywalking.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was this really like just earlier this year, a troubling story from Orange County. This was a story in the LA Times by Richard Winton. And you can see the dash cam footage of two OC Sheriff's Department, I think, deputies who are watching someone cross the street. Later, he was killed by police. But they were kind of like, oh, can we get him now? Oh, now can we stop him? Like, they were literally watching for a reason and then debating whether they could stop him or not. And then they decided that they actually couldn't. And that was Kurt Reinhold, who was killed by after the encounter with the deputy. So you can really start to see how this can, there's no real good definition who you allow to cross the street and where and why. And then, just like creating new ways for how we can make streets, how we can force the changes that need to be made for as a design perspective from a lot of these streets is going to be a really big part of this too, because if we can stop criminalize people, we can start to treat them with the same, you know, treat them the way that we treat, you know, treat all pedestrians, all users of the streets in the same way as they use the street as, and take the police out of the enforcement part of that. The other car-related legislation we have was AB 1401. And this one, we heard a lot of debate about. This seems pretty simple. It seems on the outset that it would be something that a lot of people would go for. It would just remove parking minimums, just the requirement where we say that people have to build a certain amount of parking spaces per apartment unit in apartments near transit, half mile from high quality transit, I think, or whatever we're calling that these days. And the expense created to build a parking space in an apartment building is just like jaw dropping. You have to actually, in many situations, create like, I think it's 2.3. So you have to put two cars, but also like the space to move, to navigate around this like parking garage setup. So it ends up being even more. We're digging holes in the ground and pouring concrete foundations to do these things. They add a lot of costs to the buildings, and it's been proven that it drives up the costs of development and it makes them allowed, developers aren't able to build as many units for their projects. There was,
so, I mean, it's also, it encourages people to have a car.
That's even like the whole other part of it. We have completely overbuilt our parking infrastructure. There's brand new buildings being proposed like right on the red line and purple line in my neighborhood that have hundreds and hundreds, like the parking podium for the county's new building on Vermont and like Fourth is so tall that the parking podium is taller than any building around it. And then the building goes on top of
go,
it.
I mean, it's honestly, two blocks from for people station. Who haven't been to downtown Los Angeles in a while, take the Expo Line to Pico Station or the Blue Line. There is a building that is never going to be finished. The Green Wide, Oceanwide Plaza. That entire station is surrounded by tens of thousands of parking spaces, an enormous canyon of parking in the middle of downtown, right next to the center of the region's rail network.
And so this bill seemed pretty simple on the outset. However, something we learned about as this bill started moving through the legislature, you know, started in the assembly, Laura Friedman, local representative, it was her bill. We started to hear from groups like the American Planning Association that they didn't want to give up this card, this bargaining card, because they use it to get things back from developers, which is something that I had never really thought about. Of course it happens, right? Of course it happens with a lot of things. So basically a building will be proposed, it'll have a bunch of parking, and they'll be able to use that as like a negotiating tool.
So that they will sign off on getting rid of some of the parking in exchange for like greater affordability.
Maybe affordable units, maybe like a park space of some sort. You know, I don't know. You could use this for anything if it's given to you. But the other thing to consider is most big cities in the state have already passed a version of this, right? So we're talking about San Francisco, San Diego in particular, locally, you know, they have already put these things in place. And I think the big question is like, yes, it might encourage the development of more units, but will it actually help the affordable units question? And I think that that's what a lot of the groups locally here, a coalition of groups, including like Act LA and some other...
Move LA was one of them.
Move LA, Sage, some other groups have came together and said, well, we have this, you know, pretty great system going with our density bonus program, the way that we are allocating more units, particularly around transit, that kind of works this way. It says if you, mm-hmm. for exchange and building bigger or whatever, you have to add more affordable units. So they were actually against it, this bill, without amendments. This created like a conversation, I would say, about really what is the goal. And it comes back to, I think, again, like what we're trying to do here, I think are two different goals. I think mm-hmm. one is really stopping car-centric development. We've completely overbuilt our parking. There's no question mm-hmm. of that. But then what happens when, you know, you have new buildings being built and they have, say, you know, not as many affordable units as they mm-hmm. could have been. And you've lost your bargaining chip, perhaps, with groups that are trying to work with developers. I mean, what were your thoughts on this bill?
I mean, this debate to me is, makes no sense. To me, it is completely a case of missing the forest for the trees. It's the parking minimums that we have in LA and other cities in California are absurd. They are so high. I mean, you mentioned whatever, 2.3 or something like that. I think in some cities, Glendale, Pasadena, mm-hmm. like places like that, it might even be more per unit, per bedroom or whatever.
A lot of which are represented by Laura Friedman,
who's writing this mm-hmm. bill. I mean, and so like we have this mandate that exists and has existed since the immediate post-World War II era throughout Southern California that if you are going to build an apartment, you have to provide a huge number of parking spaces. It is a climate catastrophe. Mm-hmm. If you don't think so, then just look out your window. It is completely destructive to the social fabric of LA County. And the assertion that we need to keep doing that because it is an invaluable tool, an irreplaceable tool to generate affordable housing units. By the way, I just want to say, like, respectfully, because I also feel this way. The affordable housing programs are so frequently derided as being not real affordable housing or not like actually supporting families that currently live in these neighborhoods, that to me, I cannot see a way through to be like, no, we must protect this program at all costs.
Yes.
But even if you were starting from that premise, it doesn't make sense to me because the density bonus programs, they're not all centered around the reduction of parking. It is, in the case of City of LA's TOC program, it is a menu, so-called, mm-hmm. of incentives, of which reducing parking minimums is just one. All of these are things that if you want to improve the quality of housing, generally speaking, you would want a developer to make use of more of them. They're only allowed to choose three, I think. Mm-hmm. So by eliminating parking minimums, you're not actually giving up the affordable housing element. You are allowing the developer to take a different incentive, which is good and fine. Mm-hmm. And you should just let them do that. There's not a reason to tie it directly to mm-hmm. building parking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw something really smart from Sarah Jones, who is a planning person at SFMTA, who said that we need to start thinking about parking as an amenity. Like, and it totally. Could be like at a premium price, all these different things. You know, you think about it like a gym or like a, you know, something that
like
you're adding
to. Like everything else, it raises the cost.
Right,
of,
right.
Of
and I thought that was a really good way to think about it. And then of course that would call more to the idea of a parking maximum, mm-hmm. right? Than actually, you know, I don't know. You could kind of go at the math all different ways, but it can't just be the status quo anymore. It can't just be accepted that this is what we do. And the most generous definition of why we would need more to build more parking into our buildings is to maybe get cars off the street parking, and mm-hmm. you could put it into buildings and then maybe monetize it better than so we don't have like free street parking. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the only thing I can think of as a good argument for adding more. But I mean, looking at that point, I stand in my front of my house and I look down the street and I can see that building going up on Vermont mm-hmm. and I can see mostly cars, and it makes me die a little bit inside. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. Like parking minute, we've talked about it. This is like a devastatingly stupid policy. And when developers, the initiative here among people that are against this is to, when developers say, hey, we don't want to do this devastatingly stupid thing, to say, no, that'll cost you. Or otherwise, you would have to do it. You have to add this to the sea of parking that we already have. There must be a better. And I agree with you on the affordable housing thing, too. These same organizations deride affordable housing. And it's this, like, the food is terrible, but such small portions, like, issue that we see coming up over and over again. There must be another front to this debate other than parking.
And there's a lot of other bills we'll keep an eye on we'll do another roundup, I think. But those were just two, I think, notable. Mm-hmm. And the speed camera one, those three, just I think with the way we've seen both 550, which was the speed camera bill, and what we've seen with the jaywalking bill, is this idea that we have so much work to do just to get to the point where people can use our streets in the way that they want to use them, in a way that doesn't hurt someone else, without actually criminalizing the communities that have very long been criminalized for these same actions. And yes, if you add speed cameras, like, you might take cops out of the equation, but you're also adding a level of surveillance and of data privacy, and that getting into that is also always going to affect the same communities that have been criminalized by these rules. So it really points to engineering. You know, really, we have to focus on getting the design of the streets to change, per my earlier story about Elysian Park and racing over the hilltop into Echo Park Canyon, that we really need to focus on those efforts as well. And at the state level, there's not legislation to say, you know, defund Caltrans, as we often say on this on this show. So let's get the infrastructure. And 1401 started to chip away at that. That's infrastructure. Overbuilding parking is infrastructure.
I hear that Hayes has some news about a boat.
I do. We're going back to the Long Beach waterfront. We're going back to Bubba Gump Shrimp Company.
You can smell the aquarium already.
We're spending a lot of time in Long Beach in this episode. So I want to talk about a place, to do a place and thank you segment. And the place I want to talk about is a huge boat, and it is the RMS Queen Mary, Royal Mail Ship is what that stands for, because they all had to bring the mail back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean. The Queen Mary is in Long Beach. It is in the news this week because it is broke and sinking.
Just like the monarchy.
And so what, have either of you been on the Queen Mary?
Well, yeah, not since I was a kid, though.
Okay. I went with my dad. We took a Long Beach trip and went on there. Then you'll hate this. The Queen Mary, what is it? It's a British ocean liner. It was built by Cunard, a British company that built the Lusitania to compete with its main rival, White Star, famous for a different ship.
Also broken.
Yeah.
And sinking.
Well, the sunken. Queen Mary, it was the designed to be like the biggest, fastest ship to cross the Atlantic Ocean. That was like the goal of the time, to do this really quickly. They gave out an award called the Blue Riband that they would give to whatever ship could do this the fastest. So Cunard starts building this thing. Then it's the 30s. A global depression hits. They are forced to merge with White Star, the indignity of this. Mm-hmm. And then the boat's finished in 1934. It's named the Queen Mary. Maiden voyage in May of 1936 from Southampton to New York. It wins the Blue Riband. And then pretty soon is made to become a troop carrier, because it is not a good time to bring passengers or mail across the Atlantic Ocean in a 1,000-foot-long target. During the war, it had an escort ship called the HMS Curacoa that in 1942, the Queen Mary accidentally sliced through and killed 337 sailors.
I had no idea about any of this.
You should go on a haunted ship tour because they make a big meal out of that.
Too late. It's too late to save it, though. Yeah. So.
And then they went back to carrying passengers after the war. Pretty soon people start flying on planes. Uh-huh. So they don't really want to take this very long ship journey anymore. So it was retired in 1967 and it's going to be scrapped. But Long Beach is like, no, we are developing our waterfront. We need a signature showpiece. Float this thing over here. It's too big for the Panama Canal. So you have to go around South America. But it's worth it to us. Bring it to Long Beach. And we're going to pay you $3.5 million for it. Even in 60s monies. The ship is very big.
It's very big.
It's 1,000 feet long. It makes the Titanic look like a piece of shit. It weighs twice as much as the Titanic. It consumed 1,000 tons of fuel every day.
Wow.
And so the Queen Mary comes to Long Beach. They spend a ton of money converting it into a floating hotel. So all the boiler rooms are taken out. It cannot... It is not a working ship anymore. And then it opens in 1971 to tourists. And they start opening hotel rooms. They open 400 hotel rooms. And then it's operating by Hyatt from 1974 to 1980. And then in 1980 already, they're like, this is not really working. The ship is losing a ton of money every year. The concessions and the museum and the restaurants are run by a bunch of different entities. So they start to get this idea to like put it all under the control of one company.
Would you say that this was like a midlife crisis for the city of Long Beach? They bought a big boat and then
it's just moldering in the garage. Yes. except it's like a midlife crisis, except like a different neighbor is like offering to like support your sports car every year. And then something tragic happens. This guy named Jack Rather, a local millionaire, loves the ship. Uh-huh. He and his wife, Benita, had been on the ship when it was actually operational. And so he signed a 66-year lease. They always sign a 66-year lease. It never lasts more than like 3 years in anyone's hands. He also brought in the Spruce Goose.
Okay. Oh.
The Spruce Goose was there under a geodesic dome as like part of the same property.
Package deal.
And so starting in like the 1983, he starts operating this whole complex together. He dies immediately in 1984, and his people operated until 1988 when it was bought by the Walt Disney Company. Walt Disney wanted to open something called Port Disney, a huge nautical themed complex on the Long Beach waterfront. It was going to have something called Disney Sea, which was a whole theme park celebrating the ocean. That did not happen. In 1992, Disney bails. They instead opened Tokyo Disney Sea, which has a recreated ocean liner that is supposed to look like the Queen Mary. Just like the number of indignities this ship has suffered over the years. So Disney bails. The Spruce Goose even leaves. The indignity of that, this awful plane is like, I gotta get out of here. And that was sold to an aviation museum in Oregon. A new company buys it, reopens in 1993. That company went bankrupt 2 years later. The lease was sold out of bankruptcy again in 2007 to a group called Save the Queen. They defaulted 2 years later. They got a firm called Delaware North to run it until 2009. In 2009, they quit in 2011. Meanwhile, they're trying to just wring every dollar out of this ship, mostly by saying that it's haunted and just like attracting freaks. And they do these ghost tours. They have like
Haunted Harbor.
Dark Harbor.
Dark Queen Harbor.
Mary's Dark Harbor. Should be called the Queen's Gary. There's like a most haunted suite that you can rent for $500. And so in 2016, an LA-based real estate company called Urban Commons bought this lease out of default And then they allegedly just did nothing, did not do anything to maintain it, just let it go even more to shit.
They just diversified into a floating, disintegrating asset.
It's like the Alden global capital model of they just like, yeah, let this, and then they were going to like sell it off for parts. Who knows? So then they went bankrupt. The ship now needs $300 million in repairs and $23 million in very urgent repairs, or it is going to capsize.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
The lifeboats.
I feel like you could monetize that though, too.
Sure.
It's going down.
The lifeboats on the side are now death boats. They are severely corroded. There is real risk of them falling onto the port and crushing whoever is below.
And importantly for Long Beach, which has a huge cruise industry, like if you just have like a sinking Titanic-sized vessel, that could presumably cause issues for departures of actual money generating revenue sources.
It was closed during COVID. They considered using it as a COVID hospital, but I think it was deemed too unsafe for that purpose. It was a testing site for a little while. Finally, this week, City of Long Beach says enough is enough. Mayor Robert Garcia says we can't do this anymore. They dynamited the ship to the bottom of the ocean where it belongs. No. they took control of it. And for the first time really ever, the entire ship is now under control of the City of Long Beach as of this Friday. And now they just have to figure out what to do with this thing, where to get the money to keep it afloat. Some Scottish parliamentarian is saying that he wants the Queen Mary to come home to Scotland. To which Long Beach is probably like, oh no.
What about, like, don't you think Santa Barbara might, like Montecito, Santa Barbara, with the royals living in up there now, maybe
yes.
Like the prince who's not really a prince anymore can like give a tour of like.
Yes, just make them deal with it.
This thing would get 10 feet outside of the breakwater and turn to dust. There's no way it's making it back to Scotland.
It's so weird. As I was researching it, I found myself growing attached to this ship. It is.
I love a big spooky boat.
It's an incredible vessel. The Art Deco. We talked on our bonus show about like there's a sequence in Barton Fink. Tons of movies have been filled in these amazing Art Deco.
I'm sure that'll be a reason for somebody to preserve it at its decrepit state.
But yeah, I don't think it is probably not salvageable, even in the literal sense.
Well, we've got, didn't we like throw all the subway cars into the ocean so they could like build up the reef? So let's just sink it.
And do some kind of underwater.
Yeah, then you can go down with your scuba. Park. Yeah, I think that haunted.
Like at Pearl Harbor. I mean, I feel like one thing that they could do is like extract the staterooms or something and turn it into like a Pacific dining car style restaurant.
Sure. I think that's what they've tried over the years, but I think the ship just probably smells too weird to be used by anyone now. So that's what's going on with the Queen Mary.
All right. We want to talk lastly for today about these emergency intake sites that have been set up actually across the country, sort of, mostly just in California and Texas. These are holding sites for the huge wave. This has been an enormous story in the news throughout the course of 2021 so far. There has been a historic large influx of unaccompanied children crossing the southern border into the U.S. since about October of last year. It started, but really taking off in this spring. The months of March and April saw the two single highest months of unaccompanied minors taken into Border Patrol custody on record since we started keeping these records. So what is happening currently is there are 11 intake sites that are meant to temporarily house children in the custody of the Health and Human Services Department of the federal government. And two of those, actually 11 total, but two are in Los Angeles County. One, as you mentioned, Hayes, Long Beach again, Robert Garcia was instrumental in getting a site for this purpose at the Long Beach Convention Center. The other, the county fairgrounds, the Pomona Fairplex, which opened about a month ago at this point in time.
Are those the only two in California? Or
is there is a third, okay. And it is San Diego's Convention Center.
Okay.
But in general, these are convention centers, they're warehouses, they're in one case, Fort Bliss is being used to house the largest number co-located in any one place. But generally, it's Southern California and Texas. The Biden administration has been desperately seeking locations for this purpose because when this crush of migrant children started coming across several months ago, it created a situation where all of the kids that were taken into Border Patrol custody had nowhere to go. They're by federal law supposed to be immediately transferred within, not by federal law, it's actually the result of a settlement known as the Flores Settlement. They're supposed to be transferred immediately within 72 hours out of the custody of CBP or ICE or whatever, or not ICE, CBP, into HHS custody, because the CBP holding centers, known as the ICE boxes, colloquially, that got a lot of news during the Trump administration. These are the situations in which we had minors dying in detention. They're called ICE boxes because they are freezing. They are in no way places that any child or, in fact, anybody should be left for an extended period of time. But that is exactly what was happening earlier this year. We had child migrant camps run by Border Patrol that had thousands of children cramped together. Nobody was being tested for COVID. Nobody was being, they had like what they were calling pods, but they were really just like throwing kids together into plastic cages, basically, and covering them with foil blankets. It was very reminiscent of the worst images of the Trump administration's handling of the border. The Biden administration has attempted to defuse this, and to a large extent successfully defuse that situation, by creating more space for Health and Human Services to take children out of those situations. Now, Health and Human Services is also, they are running a very different operation. And generally speaking, they have a shelter system through which the actual chain of possession chain of custody for the unaccompanied migrants theoretically should be Border Patrol agents take them, hand them over to HHS, which puts them into a shelter-like facility, and then is either releasing them into the care of, in many cases, a parent or family member who is already present in the country, mm-hmm. or failing that, a sponsor or foster care situation. The reality is that this system is not particularly efficient, and it is at this point severely overtaxed. So the shelter system, the formal shelter system that HHS runs, under HHS, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and that's important because a lot of these children are coming here as asylum seekers. Mm-hmm. They have about, 7,000 to 8,000 shelter beds. These are state licensed. They're operated by, at least in theory, they're operated by entities that have experience handling the needs of children, caring for children, dealing with the special types of trauma that they probably have experienced in their home countries, and then on the journey to the U.S. However, what we're seeing now is numbers that far exceed that 8,000 bed limit. So currently, as of the end of May, there were about 20,000 children in the custody of HHS. So the remaining, 13 or so thousand that is above the licensed shelter beds that are available. And again, COVID, as always, is playing a part here, because
they've been trying to limit as much as they can the exposure to kids being in the same congregate facilities, mm-hmm. right? So reduced capacities mean that they need to have even more space available. So so what we're seeing is about 10 or more thousand children that are going into sites like Long Beach Convention Center and like the Pomona Fairplex. The conditions, I think one of the things that is important to talk about just off the bat is like, are these jails, like are these jails in the traditional sense that we've become accustomed to thinking about, particularly over the course of the past 10 to 15 years? It's a hard question to answer.
Because it's kids. It's frankly different with kids. Like yeah. we were talking about this over chat, and it's like, yes, they are held in these facilities. They can't go outside except for like very specific times of day. And it's like, well, that is school. Like, sure. And kids cannot just be released into the outdoors.
Yeah.
But what I think is notable because of this difference is a huge cultural difference in how California cities are participating in this project compared to Trump era detention centers.
Yeah.
Where cities in LA County and the state of California banned all private detention centers. Adelanto in San Bernardino County had one of the biggest ICE detention facilities, and they cut ties to it completely. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this case, you have Robert Garcia, you have City of Pomona really, really throwing themselves into...
Hilda Solis, mm-hmm. County supervisor, actually was instrumental in securing that site and said that she was contacted. Of course, she previously served with Biden in the Obama administration, mm-hmm. said that she was contacted directly by the Biden White House and helped secure that site.
And not just securing the sites, like they've brought in the city to donate... It's like you see the rooms that they're just like piles and piles of like toys and books. Mm-hmm. There are volunteer groups coming in all the time. We were talking about the Dodgers, Albert Pujols and some other players went down there to like hang out with the kids this week. So they like it is a total difference in how these cities are approaching this. But at what point are they upholding a process that yeah. has separated kids from families and is now holding them.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the question of whether or not these are jails, I think is something that you get a very different answer to depending on how you ask. And it's sort of, like you said, it is different because they're kids. It is sort of semantic at some point because nobody disagrees that they are detention centers. Right. Mm-hmm. And so like, to what extent can you have a detention center not be a jail, or does that mean that this is the worst possible situation for them to be in? Obviously not, actually. So the conditions in the Border Patrol camps are much worse, and the conditions at the Mexican border camps are even far worse than that. So much of the discussion around this centers instead around, this is obviously not a worst case scenario, but is the Biden administration successfully doing, its responsibility to these children? Numerous groups, every last one, and, the ACLU has a number, actually a large number, I think, of lawsuits surrounding immigration issues at the southern border right now against the federal government, some of which date back to the Trump administration, some of which are newer. And there is a lot of question about how long is it reasonable for children to remain in this situation. I think that, The Biden administration has said that they agree that children should be kept in the least restrictive setting possible. Lawyers who have been admitted to the facilities have said that despite what the government is saying, particularly around children having unlimited access to speak with attorneys, a large number of children being reunited with families already, which is true. They have
kept up a steady pace of finding sponsors and family members in the U.S. to hand over children to as they await their court dates. But there is definitely a concern about the conditions at some of these locations. And there's definitely a concern about, regardless of the conditions, maintaining individual children for periods of weeks or potentially longer in the care of HHS. And again, this is an important point. The shelter system that HHS runs, which is not impeccable either, but it is state licensed facilities. The state licensure requirements vary, of course, from place to place. The website Reveal, Aura Bogado, wrote a piece a couple of years ago during the Trump administration about the conditions at some of the state licensed facilities, particularly in Texas and Florida, where abuse allegations have not led to the loss of licensure. In fact, some of those same locations are currently in use today. There is still a more permanent sense of the ability for those locations to care for children than exists at the so-called emergency intake shelter or emergency intake sites, which are what we have here. These are not required to have the same level of licensure necessarily as those longer-term shelter facilities. They are run by contractors who do not necessarily have any experience dealing with children or particular to their needs. And that has been evident. As I said, 11 of these sites across the country are currently open. Several of them have closed, and two in particular have closed as a direct result of abuses reported by newspapers and lawmakers. So those were the Dallas Convention Center, the K. Hutchinson Center, and in Houston there was another site that was more or less a logistics warehouse near the Houston airport. Texas, I should just say, is by far where the majority of the unaccompanied minors who've crossed the border, first of all, where they cross, it's also where the vast majority of them are currently located. California has maybe about 1,000 of those children currently, and I think that about 8,000 to 9,000 are in Texas. So we are under our capacity here, and also worth noting, the Los Angeles sites have not led to any direct comment about the conditions in a negative way. Javier Becerra, the secretary of HHS, was out at Long Beach when it first opened, spoke about it being very proud. Of course, it's his department, so he's likely to say that. Holly Mitchell, though, said that she was very concerned about the congregate setting for these children, that her concerns were allayed. As things progress, that's typically where the problems emerge. They all went out, of course, at the beginning. Mm-hmm. When before the sites actually had, or I think right as the sites had begun to welcome children. So it isn't clear to me that, we can say everything is proceeding. This is the best case scenario. However, what we can say is that the coverage has been far different from mm-hmm. what has happened in Texas. And part of that is probably down to the fact that at the LA sites, we have hundreds of children in large spaces at a time, as opposed to at Fort Bliss, they are planning to have 10,000 kids at any one time. And so the large mass sites are what have been reported on by the Associated Press as being a major concern, situations where at the Houston site that was closed down, that was run by a nonprofit organization that was like the National Association of Christian Churches, not actually affiliated with any church, just mm-hmm. sort of a nonprofit that the guy who was running it kept being like, I'm just a humble pastor. I don't know anything about contracting, to which you might also reasonably extend that he doesn't know anything about caring for children who are scarred by a 2,500 mile land journey to get to their present location. That site, there were really no accommodations that the government said were required to be provided, such as education, therapy services. The Houston Chronicle reported that children were given bags to go to the bathroom in instead of being allowed to take bathroom breaks. Other sites that we're aware of have these being specifically the EIS sites that we have here in LA, but other sites in Texas have had reports of children being forced to sleep in places where the lights are never off. The lights are on 24 hours a day. Not being able to... So when we say not being able to go outside, to be clear, it's not just like they can't leave the facility grounds. It's actually they are kept indoors at all times, except for short periods where they go outside to outdoor showers. Reports of children being not allowed to shower more than once a week. Reports of...
Are those in LA or are these mostly
These are mostly in Texas, but this is sort of just to indicate the concern, broadly speaking, right, with this setup.
And even in the best version of these sites, because the coverage is so different in LA County, partly because local officials are really advertising their effort to have these be better than what we're reading about in Texas. And I believe that that effort is sincere.
I do too.
But when we talk about participating in some of these, it's a really fraught thing. Scott, were explaining to me, I didn't know much about how the policies had changed throughout the Biden administration, but this system getting crushed is the result of Biden maintaining Trump's Title 42, which limited families from entering the U.S. at all, getting rid of the Remain in Mexico policy, but flying a lot of families back over to Mexico from the U.S., and then amended that policy eventually to say, we will accept unaccompanied minors. We won't turn back kids. And that led to families sending a lot of unaccompanied minors over the border, which is not like pointing a five-year-old in that direction and just like having to walk 2,500 miles. They are accompanied by individuals who then disclaim them when they get across the border.
Yeah.
People that are essentially like paid to bring these kids over. And this is done by families under the assumption, presumably, that these kids will be taken into the system and will be distributed to a relative in the United States or whatever the process is. But it is a form of passive family separation. You're forcing families to make this choice because they can't stay together as a family unit. They'll be sent back as a family unit if they go across together. So they decide to separate themselves, just send the kid. And to what extent are you upholding that system if you are a local government and building these facilities, even if you're trying to make them nice? This is even like my wife and I talked about this in the Trump administration. It's like you can extend it to like a household issue. If you decide to become a sponsor and say like, well, these kids are here, they're in this nightmarish situation, how can we alleviate the situation? Should we foster one of these kids?
Yeah.
But then are you enabling this awful system to exist? I don't know what the answer is if you're a household, if you're a local government. It's hard to make these decisions within kind of the nesting doll of policy.
And it's interesting too, because you don't really see the federal government asking people to become sponsors like that. To qualify that, the HHS is directly asking, or has been in recent months, members of all branches of the federal government, all officers
want to take care of some kids for a few months. Yeah.
Do you want to take a 4-month paid leave from your position and come help HHS operate these facilities? So, I mean, it is, I want to be clear. It is a clear departure from the Trump administration, where they were expanding the Office of Refugee Resettlement, but at the same time they were saying, we're not going to teach these kids. We don't, you know, we're just going to throw them in a room. It is a clear departure from that. They are actually trying to find the resources in order to meet the need. But I don't see, for example, the outreach isn't necessarily, we want sponsors, we want, you know, this, that, or the other thing. Mm-hmm. So I assume there's a reason for that. I don't know what it is. I do want to talk just like really briefly about Title 42, as you mentioned, because we haven't talked about it on the show. And there are a lot of very fraught aspects to this entire story, but I think this is one of the ones that is relatively more clear cut to me. So Title 42, for those who are unfamiliar, as I was until quite recently, the drumbeat of news about immigration during the Trump administration was so much and so awful that I think for a lot of people, myself included, it was just, you see a story, you know that it's bad, and then it sort of just gets replaced by the next bad thing. Mm-hmm. So Title 42, it refers to a section of federal law, which is the Public Health Services Act, a World War II era law that in periods of crisis gives the director of the CDC the ability to make rules about how to dispose of the population if there is a concern about health in general, public health. The Trump administration, which of course famously did not like the WHO, the World Health Organization, and stated that they wanted to leave the organization this year, actually, had they remained in office, that once the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic and the Trump administration followed suit by declaring an emergency related to that, Vice President Pence, acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf, pressured the head of the CDC against the advice of every CDC scientist, or many of them at least, to issue an order under Title 42 saying that anyone from places where, this is sounds so quaint in retrospect, anyone from places where community spread of COVID-19 was likely could be denied entry into the United States, particularly dealing with our land borders with Canada and Mexico. The Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration were doing this not in the interest of public health, actually, of course, because we've never really applied it to the vast majority of entrants entrants into the United States. It was specifically targeted at the migrants who were coming across the border, who were, according to the Trump administration, going to bring COVID-19 with them, spread it in border patrol camps, and that then they were going to introduce it into the U.S. Of course, that's never really been backed up by the science. And also, we're so far past that point that I can't, when I saw the phrase,
doing just fine on our own. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah. This order is pretty wild. It's like,
they're coming and taking our COVID spreading jobs.
Right.
We don't think that Mexico is going to take this pandemic seriously is one of the things that this order says.
Wow.
So what a Title 42 expulsion by DHS actually looks like is somebody comes across the border. Normally, if you're taken formally into custody, then there are a lot of legal battles that have happened in the past that establish the rights that you as an immigrant have. Before you can be deported, you have the right to see a judge, you have the right to all of these things. Of course, that system is fraught. It has a lot of delays. If you don't have a lawyer, you are likely to be deported if the country wants to deport you. But before you even get into that situation, you need to be taken into custody. So Trump, while he never built the actual physical wall between the U.S. and Mexico,
actually did something very successful with Title 42, and he built what is more or less a human wall mm-hmm. of Border Patrol agents. Since March of 2020, when this order was given by the CDC, almost 1 million people have been subject to Title 42 expulsion, which means if the Border Patrol agent encounters you, they do not take you into custody. They take you immediately over, back over the borderline, and you have no rights. You have no right to see a judge. You can't, crucially, even declare that you want to make an asylee claim. So Title 42 was initially applied to everyone, regardless of age, regardless of country of origin. If you were coming across the border from Mexico into the US, then Border Patrol agents were just going to push you back out again. There are a lot of cases where this is still being done today. And actually, I think the bulk at this point of Title 42 expulsions have happened under the Biden administration. So
because of the huge influx of individuals that came like as a result of the surge in attempted entries.
Yes. And yeah. also because contrary to an actual deportation, if you go through this mm-hmm. legal process, there are legal consequences to having been deported through the judicial system. Because expulsion is just, you know, basically we never accepted custody of you, we're just going to push you right back over, many people attempt multiple times to get through. Mm-hmm. So there have been more and more of those happening as a surge of people, of course, are at the border, and some perhaps, you know, just trying their luck, basically. Another wrinkle here, I know this is a long segment, but another wrinkle here is that Mexico, as you mentioned, Hayes, we're no longer doing the remain in Mexico policy that President Trump and Lopez Obrador of Mexico put in place several years ago. However, Mexico has started saying they are not going to accept children or families with children in their detention centers. If somebody gets expelled from the U.S., one potential outcome is that they end up in a Mexican immigrant detention center. And these are squalid. They are very bad, in the same way that the CBP ICE boxes are very bad, but potentially even more so. And so Mexico has started saying, we do not have facilities for housing children. We're not going to build them. So we're just not accepting that. And so in follow-up to that, President Joe Biden said that he would cease doing Title 42 expulsions for unaccompanied minors. And this is where we end up with the issue of self-separation mm-hmm. of families at the border. But that said, you know, this whole system is breaking down right now. Families that cross, if the Mexican officials start saying, we don't have capacity in our detention centers, then the U.S. government has the unpalatable choice of what to do with people that would otherwise just end up in a border camp like the one at Tijuana, like the one in several of the ones, Matamoros in Mexico, which no longer exists because it was the most notorious one. So generally speaking, most of the families that come across are released in a way that they would have been before the Trump era, right? So what we have here with Title 42 is a situation where the Biden administration is exacerbating, in my opinion, the harm done to these families, creating situations where they have to make really tragic decisions because we are denying, on spurious grounds of public health, anyone's ability to make an asylum claim in this country. We're just saying our goal is to prevent you from making an asylum claim, more or less. We have some nonprofits out in border camps seeking people out so that they can make asylum claims before they reach the border, but CBP is still rejecting almost everybody who comes across except for unaccompanied minors. So this is a situation where the Biden administration is, I think, trying to head off what was obviously always going to be a line of attack by Republicans, that he's opened the borders and that is, you know, he's too soft on immigration or whatever. But I don't see how capitulating to that changes.
It's happening anyway.
It's going to happen anyway.
Yeah. Just something that also our editor, Matt Tinoco, said in our offline chat was that a lot of these facilities are some of the same places that we were talking about, housing homeless residents. Like, we know that there are places that are hosting refugees from in other parts of the country. I don't think we have as much of that here, but just this idea that we need to actually start thinking about making spaces for people and in all different types of emergency situations or medical situations or immigration policies change. And unless our county is more willing to accept that responsibility in a way that is a humane and replicable way. I mean, we don't, if there's an earthquake, this all gets thrown out the window. So we really need to be thinking about, we need to have policies in place and we need to be proactive about that as a county.
That's it for our LA Podcast this week. We will be back next week on LA Podcast.